Welcome, guys, to episode 189 of Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing, and I am so excited to bring to you this week Andy Puddicombe, who is the founder of the app Headspace, the meditation app that you've heard me rave about in other episodes. So I am going to talk about his app for a second. This is not a paid commercial by any means. I just want to underline what I, you know, my opinion of it. This is the app that I talk about when I try to sleep in the station. You know, obviously your mind is going a million miles a minute. I use this app, the 10-minute segments, to deregulate, to bring myself down, to be able to get some quality sleep between these calls. I use this app as well when I come back from a high-stress call where your whole body is running 1,000 miles a minute by that point, to again deregulate and bring everything down, whether it's to go back to sleep or just to come back down to a basal level again. So I highly recommend this. There is a 10-day free trial. There's free content on there as well. And not a paid commercial, like I said. I just, in return for Andy coming on the show, I want to make sure that I highlight you guys visiting this app and trying it, because it's absolutely worth your while. So with that being said, as I always say, please go to your podcast app, rate the show, share the show, and most importantly, use social media and spread the word about each and every one of these amazing guests, because every single person that donates their time to talk to us has so much valuable information that could literally save a life if we get it to the right person. So with that being said, I introduce to you Andy Puddicombe. Enjoy. I want to start by saying thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. So where are we finding you on planet Earth this morning?
This morning I am in, I'm actually just down the road from my home in Santa Monica in California.
Beautiful. And obviously by your accent, that is not where you were born. So where were you born?
So I was born in the UK. I was actually born in North London, but I grew up in the southwest of England, very close to Bristol. And I know we were chatting just now, Jack. I thought I might have heard just a touch of the southwest in your accent.
Yes, yeah. It's kind of hidden, I think, because of the Florida thing, so that their accents sound similar. But I'm from Bath originally.
You are? Okay.
Yeah, so... Well, actually, Corsham. So you went to school in Keynsham, didn't you?
I did, yeah, yeah. So I was bang in the middle of Bristol and Bath, but I know Corsham well. Yeah.
Funny. So the first question I'd love to ask, just to get a kind of background, what was your family unit like? What did your parents do, and how many siblings did you have?
So my parents were together till I was about 10, and then they went their separate ways. My mum worked as, goodness me, she worked as a teacher, and then she trained as a hypnotherapist. She started working in stress management. So quite a sort of a similar thing to what I do now. My dad, worked looking after, the elderly in care homes. And, I had one, well, I still do have one sister who's a little bit older than me. She's now married, living in near London with one child.
Brilliant. And whereabouts in North London were you born? Just to go back to that for a moment.
In Barnet.
Okay. All right. Nice. Yeah. I lived in Highgate for a few years, so it's kind of that way. All right. Yeah. Well then, so obviously with the profession that your mum did she introduce you to meditation when you were still, the age of, age, I guess I'm trying to say.
Yeah, no, very much so. You know, it was actually a direct consequence of them getting divorced. You know, she was struggling and feeling pretty stressed out. So she was learning how to meditate, and we just went along with her, James. So I was probably about 10 or 11 at the time.
Brilliant. And then what about, I know you ended up being an athlete as far as the circus arts. What kind of sports were you into when you were young, in the school age?
Yeah, so what I lacked in academic prowess, I sort of made up for enthusiasm in sports. So I really gymnastics was probably like the first thing that I did with any degree of sort of, you know, regularity, intensity. But once I was at high school, I played on the football team, as in the soccer team, on the tennis team, athletics, basketball. I did pretty much anything I could get my hands on.
Brilliant. Yeah, and with the gymnastics, I know there's a visualization component to Headspace. Were you introduced to any of that when you were doing that sport?
To some degree, I think I'm pretty old now. That was a long time ago. But I think it wasn't really even talked about as – it definitely wasn't talked about as meditation. It wasn't even talked about as visualization. I think it was just – we were always encouraged to sort of play it through in the mind before trying to execute any particular kind of move, kind of what's that going to look like, what's that going to feel like. And I'm sure kind of some of that proved beneficial later on in the meditation.
Right. Now, what about career aspirations when you were in school? What did you dream of becoming?
I'm pretty sure it wasn't a monk. I mean, I don't remember clearly. I think I was definitely hoping for a career in sports, not necessarily as a professional athlete, but just somewhere within sports. By the time I was 18, I was working as a personal trainer. At 21, I was studying sports science at university. I was really all in on sports, so I wasn't too sure where it would take me. But yeah, that was what I was thinking.
Right. Now, I know you've talked about this in the past, a significant event happening in your personal life that then kind of started you on the path towards becoming a monk. Is that something you're comfortable telling the audience here?
Yeah, sure. And look, James, I mean, this is, you know, I'm sure you guys must see situations kind of like this all too often. But I was, standing with a group of friends outside a club. It was Christmas Eve or early Christmas morning, and a drunk driver came flying down the road, and we were just all stood on the sidewalk, and he mounted the pavement and crashed into the group. I was very lucky. I think there were three of us out of about 20 that didn't get struck. But it killed two people, and put another 12 in intensive care. So it was, I think for everybody, it was a massive wake up call at a very early age. And I think it impacted all of us sort of differently, you know, but for me personally, it definitely tapped into thoughts about the fragility of life and thoughts about the meaning of life and what it meant to live a life of purpose.
And was that in Bristol?
That was, yeah, that was in Keynsham. That was Keynsham Rugby Club.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So how did you initially process that trauma? Did it send you down a path of some negative coping mechanisms originally?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't, just because of, I think probably having grown up in sport, I didn't necessarily go to, you know, go down the drug route or anything like that. I could very easily have done, I think, had I been in a slightly different circle of friends at the time. Definitely I tried all the usual kind of stuff, maybe drinking a little bit more and going out more often, distracting myself a bit more, eventually trying to kind of go away, like hoping that I could maybe, if I moved to another place, if I went abroad, maybe kind of just getting away would kind of make it feel different. And none of those things, you know, they all added to my experience, and retrospectively, I'm incredibly grateful for doing them, but none of them really shifted that, you know, those underlying feelings and the restless quality of mind that had developed through that experience.
Right. Yeah, I've had some people that on the show that, you know, one exercise became her coping mechanism, but it became an infatuation and ended up being, she surpassed the healing part and then went too far. Another one of my guests is a firefighter. And again, that profession distracted him for about 10 years. But then after 10 years, when that kind of really the novelty wore off, that's when they crept back in again. So it's interesting that whether it's that, whether it's, you know, geographical, that thing between our ears is there, whether we like it or not.
It is. And it will always follow us, you know. So I think that was the beauty of heading off to you know, heading off to the Himalayas and going on that journey of meditation. Like out there, there is no distraction. You know, the sitting with oneself, you know, there is nothing to distract oneself with. There is no one really kind of to talk to or get away from one's own thinking. So that it kind of asks you as an individual to sit and be present with the mind as it is. And that's the good stuff, the happy thoughts, it's the difficult stuff, the challenging thoughts, it's the upset, it's everything. And I think sort of stepping out of the distraction of everyday life, can have a very sort of profound effect, whether that's for a short period of time in a day or whether it's sort of, you know, for a decade of your life.
Yeah. And what was it that actually made you make that decision? Like, do you remember the moment? Because Keynsham is not the kind of place where it's like, what are you going to do today? Well, I might just become a monk, because that's what my dad did, you know?
Yeah. All your friends in Corsham weren't heading off to the monastery, really?
There was no hair in the entire city of Corsham. We were all shaved.
It's definitely not the most obvious route, I'll grant you. And and it kind of almost mystifies me retrospectively. Kind of, I think that obviously having been around some of that growing up, and you know, I'd been exposed to meditation, I'd got along to meditation classes and meditation groups. So definitely that was kind of around. I'd been exposed to some of it at university through a few friends and a girlfriend who was kind of, you know, really into sort of Buddhism and stuff. So I think there were a bunch of influences. And as for actually making the decision, I, you know, people talk a lot about callings in life, and I think they can take many sort of shapes and forms. For me personally, this was a legit calling in the sense that I hadn't really thought about it as an idea, but when the thought came to mind, it was like it was the only thing that had ever made sense, and it just felt like I couldn't really do anything else. It wouldn't have made sense to do anything different. So I just went along with it, and I quit university and flew off to India.
Amazing. And then I know you've told this story on other podcast interviews and articles. So if you could just give us an overview of how long you were there and what your average day looked like during that time.
Yeah, so I went off. I mean, it's a weird thing, isn't it? If you're going to be a Buddhist monk, back in those days, there was no internet. So, you know, I had my trusted Lonely Planet directing me to basically where the Dalai Lama lived in northern India at the time. And so I just sort of headed up in that direction, and I found a retreat center and a monastery, and I started to get a staying there for a while. I started to get a sense of what aspects of the training kind of interested me most, and it was definitely meditation. I trained as a novice monk in the Burmese tradition, and I took full ordination in the Tibetan tradition. I was probably away overall for about 10 years. Not as a fully ordained monk all that time, training as a lay person first, then as a novice monk, and then as a fully ordained monk. I spent about 10 years overseas, and it was an incredible experience. Every day is, I want to say every day is different. As a monk, every day is the same. If you're in a monastery, then like a working monastery, then there's a balance of meditation and work. Work being sort of cleaning and cooking and just looking after the sort of general running of the place. If you're in a retreat monastery or if you're in a retreat context, then yeah, you're training, you're meditating sort of all day, every day. So sort of in Burma, that meant sort of 9 hours of seated meditation a day, 9 hours of walking meditation a day. In the Tibetan monasteries, it was maybe kind of closer to 14 hours of seated meditation a day. It depended monastery to monastery. But retreat was the thing that I kind of enjoyed the most and found most fulfilling.
Right. And an interesting thing, because I heard you talking on one of the other podcasts, it was the God, I'm forgetting the name of it now, but the wearable technology company.
Whoop.
Whoop, that was it. Whoop.
Yeah.
And it kind of reminded me, because what I love about Headspace, and I've talked about it literally for years, I think I just renewed my subscription for the third or fourth time.
Nice.
But it's so, so good for, you know, my profession and you know, a lot of people that are in associated professions. But we are kind of, you know, just we go all in on a lot of things. And obviously this profession, you have to, otherwise you know, lives are at stake. But when you think of meditation, your first mind is exactly what you've just described. And I think that puts off, you know, 99.9% of the people. But it's the same as me saying, oh, I want to kick a football around with my son. Oh, but I don't play as good as, you know, Paul Gascoigne. So what's the point, you know? So it's interesting hearing that. And then obviously looking at Headspace now with the way you partitioned it, because now it gives that, removes that barrier to entry and that fear of, you know, sitting on a cold floor for 10 hours a day in a robe, and puts it into, you can do it on the plane, the train, in the fire station, and totally bridges that gap.
Hopefully, and the amount of people on the platform suggested that it has broken down a lot of barriers, a lot of obstacles for people. I do think there's also a big sort of misconception in the West. You know, there's these two words, meditation and mindfulness, that are often used interchangeably. And I think people often, when they think of meditation, yeah, their mind immediately goes to monk, nun, yogi sitting cross-legged on the floor and the meditation kind of component. And I'll talk a bit about the meditation in a minute and why it doesn't have to be that way. But they kind of jump over the mindfulness component. And really, we only meditate so that we can familiarize ourselves with mindfulness, so that we can then apply that to the rest of our life, whether that's sort of first responders or whatever kind of we might do in life. We don't meditate to get good at sitting still with our eyes closed. So we're familiarizing ourselves with a particular quality of mind, of calm, of clarity, so we can take that into any situation in life. And for me, that's the real kind of value, the real benefit. And it's often the thing that's sort of ignored, because people just focus on the meditation. So it's almost like, okay, so we have this mindfulness, this ability to be more present in our life, which is going to help us in every aspect of our life. But then we need an environment, we need a tool, a skill that we can actually train in to get better at being more mindful in our life. And that's all meditation is, really. So yeah, when we created the app, it was kind of, how do we create the most compelling invitation for meditation, so people can get a direct experience of what it feels like to be present, to be less distracted, and so they could then get the benefit of that in everyday life. So my hope is that as people use the platform, and as, you know, just as a society, kind of our education improves around what it means to be sort of more mindful and how meditation can help us be more mindful, people will start to see how it's not something separate from life. Actually, it's an integral part of every single moment of our entire life.
Yeah, yeah. One of my closing questions on the show is always, what do you do to decompress? And there's several things that come up over and over again. One is spending time with their kids. Another one is being out in nature, whether it's hunting, fishing, you know, hiking. But all these things are them being present. And I think that's the thing. You go to a restaurant, especially here in America, you know, you're sitting down, and not only are you trying to have conversation with your family, you got the noise from all the other tables around you, you've got 500 televisions all playing, different stations flashing at you, you got your cell phones on the phone, on the table, you know, and so it's so hard just to be present. And that's what I found with this, is it's kind of like the 60-minute CrossFit workout, or yeah, the 10-minute kettlebell workout. That's your meditation, but then that applies to, God forbid, I got to climb 18 floors to go get a kid out of a building. That's when the application is.
Absolutely, 100%. For me, it's like going to the gym. If I run on the treadmill, it's not because I love running on the treadmill, one, because I want to get good at running on a treadmill. It's because I want to be fit and functional in my life and be able to do all the things that I love to do. And it's interesting. I meet a lot of people who say, kind of, look, nature is my meditation, or running is my meditation, and look, that holds to a point, in the sense that yes, it can bring about a similar kind of experience, but equally, it's really easy to go out running and in our mind just to be ticking off a to-do list for the day, to be thinking about a conversation we had the other day, or to be walking in nature, immersed in the most beautiful place in the world, and yet to be thinking about, you know, what's happening at work next week or an argument we have with a friend or something like that. And even if we have sort of a discipline like running or swimming, that's fine and it's great if it brings about the quality of calm and decompression. But what happens when we get injured? Like what happens when we can't engage in that thing? So it's all those things I think are amazing and they can be really beneficial, but they become even more beneficial when we're able to be fully present. So when we are playing with our kids, for example, we're not half with our kids and half on our phone, half thinking about what they want and half thinking about an email that we need to send. Instead, we are fully kind of present with them. And I feel like true decompression kind of happens when we are able to let go of all that stuff and be fully present in the body where we are in that moment.
Absolutely. And I want to, you know, explore the carryover and all the different, you know, external and internal stresses as well. But just to kind of connect the dots. So from the full-time, you know, actually practicing monk, what made you come back to the UK? And then more importantly, really, what made you take that expanded practice and realize that you could condense it and bridge the gap from people that really hadn't entered that world before?
Yeah, I think it was a dawning realization, you know, that there was this skill that could be incredibly beneficial to a lot of people, but nobody really kind of had access to it. I was actually living in Moscow at the time in Russia, so the monastery had asked me to teach in a meditation center in Russia. I ended up living there for four and a half years, something like that. And people would come along after work in the evening and to learn meditation. And yeah, increasingly I was meeting all these people, just regular people, regular jobs, families, everything else, who were struggling. They didn't necessarily want to, they weren't looking for enlightenment. They didn't want to learn how to chant or anything like that. You know, they just wanted to sleep better. They wanted to feel less anxious. They wanted to have happier relationships. And I knew there was this thing that could help. And yet walking around dressed as a Buddhist monk, I wasn't sort of naturally reducing the barriers to entry. So I think just over time, it started me thinking sort of, look, there is an opportunity here to introduce this in a way that it hasn't really been talked about very much, definitely within a secular context. And that sort of began the journey of sort of trying to demystify it somewhat.
Right. So just for the application to kind of, you know, underline how I've used it and why it's so important, and I think why you know, it works, and I shout from the rooftops about it. You talked about the buy-in, where, you know, walking in wearing the robes, and I think that's a two-pronged problem, I guess you could say. In our profession, firstly, if you come in and there's no connection with, let's say, fire service, police, military, whoever you're presenting to, even if you're wearing a tracksuit and it's not a robe, you know, if you've come from the local leisure center or whatever, you don't understand what it's like to work shifts, what it's like to see people die, and all these things that they're horrific, but they are part of the issue. But so a lack of understanding, then you're like, well, you guys need to do, you know, an hour, 2 hours of meditation every day. That just, there's no direct application. How I've found, and this is the reason why I was so passionate about this particular thing, is I would go run a call, and yeah, let's say 2 a.m, let's say it was a pretty bad call, come back, and you know, most first responders will tell you basically can't go back to sleep after that. I would put on the Headspace sleep app, and within 10 minutes, I'd take it out and I would go right back to sleep. And it was deregulating that nervous system that most of us are walking around with that's so highly, highly charged, whether it's before sleep, whether it's the middle of the day, whether it's after your ex just called you again, whatever it is. But those 10-minute segments are so user-friendly for our profession. And I think that was what really made it click to me, is it's like you did walk in understanding, you know, the needs of my profession, and it works, you know, flawlessly with when we need to access it.
No, it's great feedback, James. Thank you. And I'm really happy it works in that way. And you're right. It's not so much. It's interesting. I think a lot of people look at meditation, especially if they haven't, done a lot of it, don't have any experience of it, they look at it almost as a sort of a fix or something like that. Kind of like, you know, it's suddenly going to change anything. Where actually, it is much more about balancing out and regulating, helping physically us move from sympathetic to parasympathetic sort of state, where we do or are able to sort of relax and unwind a little bit, and at a psychological level where we're more able to let go of a lot of the rumination and a lot of the inner dialogue that typically we carry around with us. And that's, yeah, if it's at night time, it's in the middle of the night, that can be really distracting. It can stop us sort of getting to sleep during the day. It prevents us from being fully engaged in the world in which we live. So just having that as a skill, just balancing things out, I think can make a real difference.
Yeah. Well, we're focusing on the daytime first, because I really want to delve into sleep in a moment. But what I found, yeah, doing the practice is when we had an emergent call, I was able to be a lot calmer on the way there, and I would even use some of the same breathing techniques on the way to the call. And then when you got there, you had a wide focus as far as, you know, at any potential risks, so you weren't blinkered, but then you were very focused as far as the job in hand and weren't running around like a chicken with his head cut off either. So I found that, again, that when you put the work in by doing, you know, the practice, you know, every day, every other day, whatever you're able to do, everything became more relaxed and more efficient.
Yeah. I love that. I love the picture you painted there. I think a few people have talked to me about sort of almost experiencing sort of a Matrix type moment where everything sort of just begins to slow down. Like, everything's still happening real time, but our experience of it, our perception of it, is that everything is slowing down, and so we have more time to make decisions. And I think typically in life, our mind is so busy that we tend to react to things. So, I mean, I can only imagine in a critical situation, you know, like you might be attending, if you react to, on the one hand, we need to respond very quickly, but if we react hastily, we could end up making the wrong decision. If we can create a quality of mind where the mind is actually calm, but highly alert, highly focused, but we have enough space to respond skillfully, then we make a better decision in that moment. So I think it's really tempting for people who don't know a lot about sort of meditation to think that it gets you in a particular state of mind. Maybe it's very relaxed, very calm, but actually it's training in awareness. So yes, we can use it to relax and calm down, but we can also use it to be highly alert, highly efficient, and to make good decisions in very challenging situations.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that being present is very important, whether it's in the actual job or, again, like you said, in the training. So you got the meditation training itself, we got our fire training too. And let's say, for example, we are climbing, you know, 20 floors up with all your gear. Well, instead of thinking, oh my God, I got 19, I got 18, if you're just focusing and being in that moment and thinking about every single step, then it takes away the anxiety of the what ifs when I get up there. Let me just focus. All I have right now is this. I have this load, and I have the next, you know, step or two to get up. And then you just keep cycling and cycling. Before you know it, you're up there and you are focused instead of working your way into a frenzy by the time you get up.
Yeah, I think that's a great metaphor kind of across the whole of life, actually. But just being able to let go of the thinking, which fuels the emotion. So anxiety, for example, can only exist if we're fanning the flames of anxiety. So we have to be applying a lot of thinking around the anxiety for the anxiety to continue. If we're able to let go of the thinking, then the anxiety will subside, and we're then able to be more present. So we're not thinking about what did happen just now. We're not thinking what might happen or could happen at the top of the ladder. Instead, we are just fully present in the body, one run to the next.
Yeah, exactly. And I know this has been said many, many times, but I think it's such a powerful statement. Depression is worrying about the past, and anxiety is worrying about the future. So if you are present, in theory, you're basically eliminating both of those stresses.
Yeah, and the I think the temptation it can be is, when people begin meditation especially, is to think that they are immediately going to be free from those stressors. and that they are immediately going to be living in the present moment all of the time. My experience and the experience of most people is that this is a journey. And so I think it's also really important to highlight that, yes, we can experience those things less frequently, but I would say it's even more valuable than that. I would say that through regular meditation, through regular mindfulness, we can get to a point where when we experience anxiety in the mind, we don't necessarily kind of buy into it. We don't necessarily engage with it. Instead, we're actually okay with it. And when sad thoughts arise in the mind, we don't necessarily engage with them. We don't necessarily buy into them. We're okay with them. And that's actually, in a way, is way more freedom than simply being free from something. If we're okay with the mind in good times and in bad times, that's absolute freedom, because then we're no longer concerned. We're no longer trying to maintain a certain quality of mind, and we're no longer trying to keep certain thoughts and emotions at bay. Instead, we are genuinely able to be at ease with the mind, no matter how it appears in each and every moment. But as I say, that is a journey.
Yeah, yeah. And I noticed that, funny enough, with, I think road rage is the wrong description, just getting wound up by other people's driving, because it wasn't like I was out there dragging them through the glass or anything. But you know, before I would react, I would get angry. And this was definitely a part of sleep deprivation as well, so I acknowledge that. But what I found with the using the headspace was, just like you said, I would acknowledge, yes, that person is still driving like an asshole. There's no question about that. However, I choose not to react the same way, because it's going to have no effect on the world if I get wound up. They probably don't even realize they just cut me up anyway. So the awareness of my reaction to the exterior world was a big change.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, that, as I said, you know, it's not that everything around us is suddenly going to change and that all the difficulties and challenges of life are suddenly going to disappear, but our perspective of them changes. And in that space, in that renewed sort of perspective, there is the opportunity to actually kind of let go of some of the old habits that we might have engaged in over the course of a lifetime. And as a direct result, kind of, maybe we do feel a bit less stressed, and maybe we are able to be a bit more sort of positive in the world and a bit more connected with the people around us.
Absolutely. Well, I want to just explore sleep, because that's, as I mentioned before, that's where I used it the most. I would often use it before, you know, I quote unquote went to sleep and in a fire station waiting for an alarm to go off. It's not technically sleep. It's just closing your eyes for a bit. But the 10 minute segments that you had, the sleep segments, I really, really enjoyed. Now, from all your experience with, you know, the importance and quality of sleep, what's your perspective on exactly that? You know, how much have you learned about the value of sleep and then the application of headspace to help that?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because in the monastery, for example, you know, we might only sleep for, you know, again, in retreat kind of context, and this can often be for sort of years at a time, you might only sleep for sort of 4 hours a night. So the sleep has to be incredibly efficient to fully recover. Obviously, it's a very different environment, and you don't have the same sort of stresses involved and the same level of distraction. But at the same time, it definitely made me acutely aware that it's not the number of hours that we sleep, it's the quality of rest we have while we're sleeping. So, you know, I know lots of people who sleep for 10 hours a night and wake up, lucky people, I know, wake up feeling exhausted. They, you know, they're still tired when they wake up in the morning, and they feel like their mind has been churning away sort of all night. And I know people who've slept for considerably less who wake up feeling very alert. So I do think it's really important that we pay attention to not just, yeah, how many hours we're spending in bed with our eyes shut, but also to the quality of rest we're getting. And there are a few things we can do. I think one, this is hard to sort of maybe wrap your head around immediately, but simply having a regular meditation practice in the daytime will help lead to a better night's sleep. So we don't necessarily, basically what happens is usually in every day we get to bedtime We've been so busy. As soon as we put our head on the pillow, it's almost like with nothing to do, all those thoughts then stream into our mind and they can sort of prevent us from getting to sleep. If we have a regular meditation practice, we're less likely to store up all those thoughts during the day. There's a sense of them being released as we go through the day. So therefore, when we get to bed, we're more likely to be able to fall asleep. So having a regular meditation practice can help. Doing some, we have loads of unwinding exercises on the app. So these are designed specifically before you go to bed, almost sort of in the same way that you'd warm up for exercise of any kind. In the same way, you're sort of preparing the mind to wind down and be, yeah, and it be in a state where it will comfortably sort of drift off. And then there are even exercises, you know, that you can do, as you say, if you wake up in the middle of the night to sort of help you go back to sleep. But ultimately, yeah, we're looking for a quality of rest rather than simply more time in bed.
Yeah. And I think it's such again, we talk about negative and positive or healthy coping mechanisms with a lot of the physical stresses, the mental stresses. And there's a huge epidemic really of alcohol use in our profession, of, you know, pain pill use, and then sleeping medicine as well. And all of those just destroy your quality of sleep. So to be able to find something that actually is going to be beneficial 24 hours a day, but will give you that deep restorative sleep, and then you can start weaning yourself off those crutches that you use, I think is very powerful.
Yeah. And again, I can only imagine how easy it would be to go down any of those routes working in your profession. But as anyone who has gone through long-term use of any of those things will testify, it is most definitely not a comfortable, long-term, sustainable solution. And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's not about kind of immediately sort of swapping this out. It's about, you know, introducing this as an additional sort of skill in toolkit, if you like, and at the same time working with a health professional, if that's necessary, to slowly sort of wean yourself off maybe some of the other less healthy supports that might have been used in the past.
Right. Now, you mentioned health professional. I saw an article where I think it was the Evening Standard, where you'd had referrals from local GPs, and I found that quite interesting. So what's the story behind it? Were they regular GPs, and what kind of people were they sending you away?
Yeah, funny enough, that was actually, so even before I started Headspace, so I went back, after the monastery, I went back to, after Russia, I went back to England, and I spent a number of years working in a clinic doing just one-to-one stuff, private practice, and it was an interdisciplinary health clinic. There were people like across the board. There were sort of cardiac specialists, orthopedic. I mean, it was really, really broad, and it was run by a guy who was just very sort of progressive. And he had this idea that if he brought enough people from different disciplines under one roof, then no matter who walked in the door, no matter what was wrong with them, he would have the people to sort of help. And so I would see people, if people were in there, it was normally stress-related conditions. Either they were struggling with insomnia, anxiety, depression, irritability, those types of things. I would either see them alongside another sort of a GP who was either just monitoring their condition or maybe even prescribing them some medication. Or occasionally, if they felt that it didn't warrant medication, but the meditation would be helpful, then I would see that individual separately. And I used to see people, it was a course that I ran there. So it was a 10-week course. I'd see people for 1 hour a week over a 10-week period. And we'd kind of work not only on what was going on with them at that particular moment, but also on a sort of a longer term strategy. So at the end of the 10 weeks, they'd actually have a skill they could take away and apply to any part of their life.
Yeah, I think that's incredible. I mean, I hear more and more of the power of psychotherapy and a lot of the, you know, the mental health issues too. Even use of MDMA recently to get rid of the barriers when they're talking them through it. But it all results in a good psychotherapy, which again is self-talk. And I think they give them tools as well. But it's amazing to me how powerful that is versus being prescribed a bunch of psych meds and being told to come back in 30 days.
Yeah, it's massive. I think it's such a it will require such a cultural sort of change. I think it has been a certain way for such a long period of time. But I'm actually really encouraged when I look at what's happened in the last 10 years. You know, 10 years ago, we couldn't even really talk about meditation or mindfulness without people kind of giggling. There's now sort of 45 million people on the platform. And over those last 10 years, you know, we've only been one part of the conversation, but the conversation just around mental health has moved on massively. Perhaps more so in the UK than here in the US. I don't know. I definitely going back when I go back to the UK and back to Europe, I'm amazed now at, you know, whether it's within workplaces, whether it's within healthcare, there is just a general acknowledgement now that, you know, our mental health is just as, if not more important than our physical health. And unless we kind of introduce a culture where people feel okay to be able to talk about this stuff, to feel okay to be vulnerable in their work, in their relationships, then we're really going to struggle. So I actually think things have moved on, and I'm excited about sort of the pace at which they're moving in some areas of the world.
Brilliant. Now, I know the Dalai Lama famously said if every 8-year-old in the world was taught meditation, it would eliminate violence in a generation. And I know I actually looked online, there was someone that was poo-pooing the whole thing. But the reality is, obviously, we know, like we just discussed for the last 40 minutes, that there is nothing but, you know, positive benefits from this. What's your philosophy on actually implementing that in schools and getting kids to understand mindfulness and meditation at an early age?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously having benefited it from a young age myself. I'm a huge advocate of that, and it's something we've worked on really hard at Headspace. So even within the app, you know, there's Headspace for kids, 5 and under, 6 to 8 and 9 to 11. We have loads of people who kind of use it with kids as young as 3. I think that's really exciting. I love the statement that he came out with. I love the sentiment of it. I think it will take, you know, this is a generational kind of thing. It will take time, but most schools that I know of have mindfulness in their curriculum to some extent. Sometimes it's teachers of their own volition, just bringing it into the classroom because they found it beneficial themselves. Over here in the US, we currently make Headspace available to all educators for free. We've reached somewhere close to 500,000 teachers in the US. It's available in tons of schools. And I think we're working with, I could be wrong, but the last count is something like 70-odd school districts across the US. We internally feel like setting the next generation up with these skills so that they don't have to wait till they get to the point where they feel like they're struggling with their mental health. Like that is the way forward.
Absolutely. And on the other side of the scale, have you done any work in prisons, bringing meditation into there?
Yeah, we have done. So back in, I don't know in the US actually, but back in the UK. So when we were trying to work out sort of how we were going to be engaged in sort of more sort of philanthropic type work, we worked a lot with sort of help centers, addiction centers, prisons, and also sort of homes which cater for people when they left prison and returned to everyday life, and that's often sort of a period of real kind of challenge. And it's been really, it's been fascinating. There's a ton of research online that people can have a look at about sort of the work that's been done with meditation inside prisons. But I do think there is a real opportunity. There are, just from a very sort of practical point of view, not only is it a very sort of challenging environment where people would benefit from these skills, but there is also the opportunity and the time in which to learn these skills. and where they can be an important part of rehabilitation, of acceptance, and developing a healthy sense of self-worth and compassion as they head back out into society. And I feel like that's a really missing component from sort of the penal system generally.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's a lot of, you know, men and women that are, you know, got childhood trauma that they got to deal with. They've, you know, got the addiction that they use to fill the void. And there's so many areas there that you could see would be beneficial if they replace that with exploring their own mind. Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to touch on one more area before we talk about Headspace. I kind of want you to paint the picture so everyone knows exactly what is available to them. But I know you were diagnosed with cancer. So being someone who was a monk for 10 years, I'm very holistic, you know, in the way I look at food and treatment. What were the changes that you made in your life to overcome that?
Yeah. So I was diagnosed with cancer just after I came out to America. And it's really important to say at the start, I'm not recommending a particular course of action here. This is a very personal thing that's different for everyone, and you've got to do it alongside your doctor and everything else. But yeah, for me, like having grown up in a culture where, you know, meditation was, you know, part of growing up, and alternative health and acupuncture and nutrition, all that stuff was stuff I'd grown up with, and obviously kind of in studying sports and things as well, that all kind of fed into it. So yeah, when I found out that I had cancer, I needed to have an operation straight away, which I had, and then they wanted to do sort of more aggressive surgery and also go down the route of chemo and everything else, and I just didn't feel like that was right for me at that time. So I went and got a second opinion, and then a third, and then a fourth, and on the sixth opinion, I found a doctor who thought in a similar way to me. And we came up with a plan, and obviously meditation was and more meditation was a really important part of that plan, changing nutrition as well. So again, this is controversial. Some people are into it, some aren't, but we went on an alkaline diet, ate nothing but raw food for a year with my wife, who very kindly joined me at the time. And I made sure that I was just getting more rest than I had been previously, and starting a company and moving to a different country and everything else. There have been a lot going on. So it was sort of modifying some of life behaviors, making sure I was getting enough exercise, that I was eating the right food, that I was doing enough meditation, and for me personally, that was my way of working with quite a challenging situation.
And what was the outcome?
Well, this is so far so good, my friend.
There we go.
We're five years on now. And there's been no sign of it yet. It's an interesting one. Kind of, I think meditation has taught me that, apart from anything else, that the, you know, these things just in life, you know, everything comes and goes, and it doesn't mean kind of that it's gone kind of forever. And I would say that, you know, it will drift in and out of my mind, you know, kind of. Maybe it comes up in conversation with someone, and I don't think I ever kind of feel like I'm just not of that personality where it's like, oh, I've beaten it. Because I don't feel like I ever, you know, I created some conditions for the body to heal, but I don't really kind of believe I beat it. Kind of nature just played out that way within those conditions. And so, yeah, Hope all being well, it will remain that way. But yeah, I just feel kind of the most useful thing kind of throughout that process. And so many people, you must have spoken to loads of people, James, who feel the same way. But I feel like those things are a real gift when we survive them, because, you know, they do remind us of what's important in life. They do encourage us to feel more grateful. And having meditation on that journey, where it would have been so easy to get, you know, strung out and to think about what could happen, what might happen, and instead to just be present and being okay with just not really knowing along the way, that was a really valuable thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it goes back to what you said about the tragedy in Keynsham. You know, I mean, you could be 100% healthy and then a drunk driver plows into you and right. your friends. So yeah. there's no way of knowing. But just to me, the philosophy of taking all the natural tools that our ancestors thousands of years ago has had to put the body in as close to as homeostasis as you can, to my medical mind, makes a lot more sense than blasting the body with radiation or chemicals and destroying the immune system.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, you know, another time, another situation. If, you know, and I think that's the other thing as well. You know, I think it can be really easy to look at life in a very sort of black or white kind of thing. And, you know, I feel like meditation and mindfulness, it's not, you know, some people will say, you know, oh, but what about sort of medication? You know, is it medication or meditation? And I feel like these things are complementary. And sometimes, you know, if I was in a real tight spot and I needed kind of surgery, I would not be going to my local acupuncturist to have a treatment. I would be going to the doctor, to the hospital to have surgery, because I know it's amazing that we have those things. But from a long-term preventative type of thinking, I think it's really helpful to explore like all the different things that are out there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing. I try not to demonize medicine. I try to be clear and preface a discussion with, yeah, if I got nailed by a car and broke my femur in two, I'm not going to go to a chiropractor and say, hey, can you pop that back in? I'm going to go to a trauma surgeon. But yeah, chronic disease, when I know, you know, I know there's no question that you can reverse so many of these so-called irreversible diseases through nutrition, through, you know, mental practice, yoga, all those things combined, then, you know, you really do not need to be a drug addict on some statin for the rest of your life. All right. Well, let's take a moment then to, if you wouldn't mind, just to tell people listening, you know, how to access the platform, what types of meditation, you know, practices there are and the lengths, just so they get a kind of mental picture of what you have out there.
Yeah. So look, you can download the app, either from iOS App Store or from Google Play Store. And when you first download it, so you don't need to subscribe in order to use it and to try it. So we work with a system whereby there is free content on there that you can use forever, as long as you like. If you want access, once you've learned the basics, if you want access to more content, then it's a subscription kind of model. And once you go into that library, yeah, there are 10, 20, 30-day courses on everything from productivity and focus and performance to sleep, stress, anxiety, self-esteem. There's a sports channel for those people that are specifically looking for help with either preparing for sports in the performance itself or in the recovery. There's headspace for kids. And the idea is that you can kind of create your own journey, you know, and you kind of access the content that feels right for you at that time. And you can choose. You don't, you know, as I said at the beginning, you don't have to sit for a really long time. You can choose a session length as little as 3 minutes or 5 minutes. I'd recommend slowly, if you can, try and build up to sort of 10 minutes. But the idea, as I say, is that this is a facility that you can access and implement and integrate into your own life. As it exists, you don't have to make big changes necessarily in your own life to make room for this. And yeah, every exercise is different. There are some that focus more on the breath, for example, sort of focused attention type exercises, which are really good for training sort of a relaxed focus in the mind. There are others that are more sort of visualization orientated that can be really helpful for sort of encouraging an environment for healing in the body. So again, there are lots of different techniques in there, different ways of sort of cultivating these qualities of mind that most of us would like to experience a little bit more often.
Yeah, and that 10-minute segment that you're talking about, again, to me works so well in our profession, because, you know, when you first gets us to the station, or you know, in your patrol car, whatever it is that you're doing, that's a mount where you can just kind of control alt delete your brain a little bit. And then because you've only done the 10, that frees up a lot of time where if you want to revisit it later in the day, you have a stressful call or you're, you know, getting ready to do an exercise that you're actually pretty anxious about and it scares you, whether it's heights or water or whatever it is, then you can revisit it again. And I think those segments work extremely well for the jobs that we do.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. And we actually specifically recognizing that people didn't always want to sit down for, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes. There's even an SOS kind of channel sort of in there as well. So that, you know, let's say you're feeling particularly anxious about something. It doesn't mean that you have to do a whole kind of exercise. You know, you can just plug it in. And for 3 minutes, you know, you'll be sort of coached through with a mindfulness exercise that will help sort of de-escalate the sort of the panic in the mind. So my hope is that there is something in there for everyone.
Brilliant. All right. So I got some very quick wrap up questions then. I know we've got just a few minutes left. Is there a book that you love to recommend to people? Just to say, so you've written 3 books, To Get Some Headspace, The Headspace Diet, and The Headspace Guide to Mindful Pregnancy. So I want to make sure that we mention those as well. Are there any books by other people that you love to recommend?
There are. Most of them are pretty niche, obviously, given my backgrounds and my interests. But look, there's one I'm going to throw out there, which I think is amazing. It is meditation specific, but it's bigger than meditation. It's kind of about life. It's about awareness. It's called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, by a Japanese chap called Suzuki Roshi, who came over to America, I think back in the 50s or 60s, and settled in San Francisco. It's just a book which really encourages this idea of pulling back from the confusion of our inner dialogue and just gets us looking at our mind, at our relationships, and at the world in a very different way.
Brilliant. All right. And then I'm just going to ask one other rapid question. Is there a person that you would recommend to come on this podcast to talk to the first responders of the world?
Goodness me. You put me on the...
That one normally snags a few people, and I don't mean to.
Do you know, I mean, I don't know if he'd do it, but the Tibetan Lama that I trained under, I think would be really interesting, you know? Like, it's not like he's led his whole life just, again, sitting around a monastery with his eyes closed. I mean, those guys, in escaping Tibet, they spent 6 months going over, sort of traveling over the Himalayas by foot, being shot at by Chinese soldiers. More than three quarters of the group he traveled in died of either hypothermia or starvation. And it's amazing listening to someone like that who has been through really kind of, you know, life-changing events in his life and how that's been put to good effect in leading a sort of a happier and more positive life. I think he could be a really interesting one. It's a bit left field, but hey.
This is a left field show, I promise you. So I've had child soldiers, you name it. I've had all kinds of people on here. So
I'll ask him. Next time I see him, I'll ask him.
That would be amazing. Thank you. All right. Well, I just want to say thank you so much. I can imagine how busy you are, but not only talk to you, but then to realize that we grew up a few miles from each other is even more more of an impact.
Small world.
So thank you so much.
Thank you, James. Thanks for having me on.